Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi, I'm Kirsty Major, Commissioning Editor at The Independent, and this is Double Take, a podcast in which our writers come into the studio to read and discuss one of their opinion pieces. It could be their weekly column or something from the archives that shines some light on this week's news. This week, I'm joined by Ash Sarkar, Senior Editor at Navarra Media, who will be reading and discussing her piece, "The Working Class Isn't as White as Some Would Like You to Think."
So much for the sans-culotte of the deindustrialised Rust Belt. When the citizenry of Trump's forgotten America showed up in Charlottesville, it was in sports jackets and chinos. This was not the culture war the commentariat had prepared us for. Rather than Arlie Hochschild's blue-collar Joe consigned to the scrap heap by globalisation, or indeed Joan Williams' ordinary working stiff beset by cultural and economic anxiety, the ruddy faces of Unite the Right looked positively bougie. It's become a truism repeated to the point of banality that across the global north, a revival of working class political engagement has driven electoral successes for the nationalist right. Dispossessed by globalist elites and mocked by a cosmopolitan intelligentsia, this demographic has been long underserved by our political classes and neglected by the identitarian gatekeepers of cultural relevance. Better writers than myself have debunked much of this narrative. In the UK, as well as the US, the economically downtrodden are not racially homogenous. What's more, the existence of racial inequality makes itself known in economic outcomes. Black and Asian minority ethnic households in the UK are twice as likely as their white counterparts to be amongst those hardest hit by austerity, and Black and Asian minority ethnic workers are overrepresented in insecure and low-paid forms of employment. Between 2010 and 2015, long-term youth unemployment fell by 2% for white people. In the same time period, it rose by 50% for Black and Asian minority ethnic youth. As Maya Goodfellow observed, the media fixation on the white working class is not only misleading, it is an example of the very identity politics it claims to deride. We find ourselves in a landscape where, in Owen Hatherley's words, class is depoliticised, framed as a sort of nationality based on accent, culture, and a particular set of views rather than an economic relation. This has not always been the case in the UK. While cultural anxieties regarding race and immigration have plagued the British political imaginary since the days of empire, left-wing and anti-racist movements of the 1970s and 1980s suggested a different basis for understanding inequality. The Grunwick strike of 1976 saw 137 predominantly Asian and female striking workers joined by 20,000 protesters, with Arthur Scargill and striking, mostly white and male, miners backing their dispute. Working class Londoners of colour set up monitoring shops in every borough in response to far-right and police violence. Organisations such as Black People Against State Harassment, BASH, were set up as community self-defence initiatives, and while it wasn't without its internal divisions and problems, there was a lively and populist anti-racist movement in the UK. The breaking of the miners' strike in 1985 and the anti-trade union crusade that followed has long been hailed as the demise of working class political organisation in the UK. Arguably just as important is the response of Thatcher's government to the riots of 1981 and 1985. After decades of police harassment under racist sus powers, an informal name for a stop and search law, managed decline of urban centres, and high-profile instances of deaths following police contact, tensions twice boiled over into outbreaks of mass disorder across the UK as working-class people of colour took to the streets. Thatcher had previously been to the right of the Conservative Party on issues of race and immigration. Following the Brixton riots, however, her government set about implementing the findings of the Scarman Report, which recommended nationwide funding of cultural projects to include ethnic minority communities in a sense of national belonging. The urban programme's budget blossomed to £270 million, and 200 new ethnic projects were approved between 1982 and 1983. Such ethnic projects did little to mitigate the rampant inequalities in housing, employment, and healthcare, which grew under Thatcher's neoliberal agenda. State multiculturalism was a program to constrain the political effectiveness of anti-racist and industrial movements. The watchword of the day became representation rather than wealth redistribution. By focusing on race relations, Thatcher turned a project of anti-racist socio-economic justice into one of ethnic representation, and the working class was split along racialized lines. The contradictions of the multicultural project continued under Tony Blair. While the 1997 government were hailed as diverse modernizers, income inequalities and associated racialized outcomes widened under New Labour. The 1999 McPherson Report's identification of institutional racism in the Metropolitan Police and the protection of minority rights by the Race Relations Act 2000 made it seem like Blair's brand of cosmopolitan social democracy was a victory for anti-racist organisers of the 1980s. However, in 2003, Home Secretary David Blunkett dismissed institutional racism as a mere slogan which missed the point. Immigration enforcement officers were made exempt from the Race Relations Act, which called open season on state harassment of non-EU migrants. Having separated out Black and Asian minority ethnic communities from the national conception of class, Blair's agenda began to exclude working-class migrants too. As the BNP made electoral inroads in the white flight ring around London, New Labour became intent on being seen as just as hard on asylum seekers as their far-right competitors in order to preserve community cohesion. However, as Aaron Kunani has noted in The End of Tolerance, the case for being tough on immigration was as much about capital as it was about culture. Under New Labour, the number of successfully granted asylum applications halved in the space of 2 years. In the same time period, the number of temporary work visas doubled, creating a precarious, hyper-exploitable, racialised working class. These workers are the forgotten, the most vulnerable amongst a working class that was never as white as we'd like to imagine it. Who are the white working class? If anything, they're just as much a product of state multiculturalism as the diversity czars decried in the pages of right-wing tabloids. A cultural analysis, with its attendant vocabulary of identity, community, and belonging, fails to tackle the very real material inequalities that continue to widen in our society and disproportionately impact people of colour. It would be a mistake for Corbyn's Labour Party to hark back to a socialism which assumes racial homogeneity, or to continue the discourse of an authentocracy in which class is just a set of cultural distinctions. The disintegration of neoliberal consensus across the global north presents us with an opportunity for a renewed politics of social and economic justice. Projects of wealth redistribution are nothing without an anti-racist backbone. It's the alt-right who want a culture war. The rest of us are just after a decent living.
If you would like to have your say on the piece, you can tweet Ash at AOCZEP and me at Kirsty_Major. Up next, we'll be talking about what actually constitutes class in the UK.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hi, Ash.
Hey, Kirsty.
So when we commissioned this piece from you, you told me a little story that one of the monitoring shops that you mentioned in your piece, your mum and dad met at one of them.
Yeah, so clearly they had their eye on something other than police violence. I don't know if it undermines their activism, but yeah, they met doing new monitoring project, which is one of the few monitoring projects which still exists to this day.
So do you feel like when people talk about working class in the UK, that part of your own family history and indeed your own history gets erased when people talk about it just in terms of whiteness?
Completely. Not just in terms of race, but also gender. So particularly in critical race circles or in histories or in British historical circles, we talk about the fact that waves of migration occurred post-World War II to fill certain labour shortages. And when we imagine those labour shortages, we gender that work as predominantly male. Mm-hmm. So we think about things like bus conductors, or we think about factory work. What we don't talk about is the situation that my grandmother found herself in. She was 17. She came to this country in 1954, I think it was. She moved just onto North Road near Caledonian Road. Mm-hmm. And she was working as a care worker, which was another labour shortage. So, you know, this kind of newly created NHS and care system needed predominantly, you know, black and brown, predominantly female workers to come and staff it. So one of the things I'm trying to get at in this article is that we suffer from a selective cultural memory in which we racialize the working class as white, and when we don't, it's predominantly male.
Do you think that that's done purposefully? So when you talk about Thatcher and you talk about Blair, do you feel like that was, you know, set out as an agenda, or do you think it was the result of, you know, implicit biases within policymaking?
The breakup of the working class into discrete ethnic and cultural communities was a concerted project. It didn't happen overnight, and it didn't happen by accident. You read interviews with not just UK Home Secretaries, but also, say, Reagan's Secretary of State. These projects of funding, which also went hand in hand with the over-policing of certain communities, was intended to break up black socialist radicalism on both sides of the Atlantic. So you think about what happened at the end of the Black Power movement. You had the most senior organizing figures incarcerated or indeed murdered by the state. And then others were kind of ossified in, you know, the bureaucracy or in the state apparatus itself. And I think you find the same over here. So you had very prominent members repeatedly harassed by the police or attacked violently by police in terms of black anti-racist organizing from the 1970s onwards. And then those that didn't were kind of softened by just enough money to achieve projects of representation, but that significantly moderated the message of redistribution.
Do you think it was also, as well as being at the policy level, do you think there's a cultural level where, I don't know, film, TV, British culture overemphasized and overrepresented the white working class? So I'm thinking, you know, Your Only Fools and Horses and Your Steptoe and Sons, and maybe books like Don't Look Back in Anger, mm-hmm. Versus books like Lonely Londoners by Sam Selvin. Like, I feel like one part of that canon gets overrepresented than the other. Do you agree?
Yes, certainly. I think The Lonely Londoners by Sam Selvin is a great example of this.
If listeners haven't read it, it's just one of the most beautiful books.
It's perfect. And I think it's one of the best accounts of living poor in London that I've ever read. And it's just as relevant today as it was at when it was published. I'm not thinking so much about the kitchen sink tradition of UK fiction and drama. I love that kind of stuff myself. Because it's very dangerous to start saying, well, just because the white working class is a sociological construct, it means that white working class households, individuals and neighbourhoods don't exist. They very much do. And that representation is important. But you look at the cultural moment of the early 2000s. And do you remember the BBC had The White Season?
No.
So it was a series of films and programmes, mostly one-offs, which are about white people, white working class mm-hmm. people. I remember watching one which I thought was a load of rubbish, to be honest, where a white girl converts to Islam and everyone loses their mind. So these projects are very well funded and very politically effective when you consider at what point in British political history is this coming out. So the BBC's White Season is kind of at the Blair Project zenith in terms of, you know, increasing public-private finance initiatives, in terms of widening inequalities, in terms of getting a never-ending war on terror started both domestically and abroad. So it's not just about saying like, oh, Ken Loach, can you not? Because, you know, love my man Ken. But looking at how, again, coming back to policy and funding, how and when these things come about.
I wonder also we can talk about, as well as it being at the policy level and the cultural level, in terms of the right, so like Thatcher and Reagan over in the US and the centre with Blair, but also identity over material concerns. And when I say material concerns, I mean like you know, your economics, your bread and butter, what's coming in and out of your bank account. The left are also really keen on identity. So I feel like it's a conversation which is sort of like, I think you described it as like the register of the individual, like only talking about politics from an individual perspective rather than a structural perspective. Why do you think that has come about?
I mean, this is where we as anti-racists really have to hold our hands up and say, look, we have been just as affected by neoliberal hegemony as the centre has, or the white left, or the right has. I think there's a reason why when we talk about intersectionality, it's not in the way that Kimberlé Crenshaw had intended it to be. We start looking at it as a kind of oppression Olympics where you kind of stack up these subject positions and from that you assume greater authority to speak on things. That's not what Kimberlé Crenshaw intended.
So for listeners who maybe haven't read up on what intersectionality is, can you kind of explain what it is and what it was supposed to be?
For Kimberlé Crenshaw, intersectionality is a way of explaining the politicized experience of black women in America. So you're not just a woman and your political heritage isn't just the feminine mystique until now. It's saying that this there's an intellectual history, which kind of goes from women who were organizing against slavery right through to the kind of 1970s womanist movement, and that there are very particular social, economic and historical forces shaping your experience. So it's not primarily a matter of identity at all. It's looking at how power dynamics shape positions of vulnerability. So you're not just a woman, you're a black woman, or you're a black disabled woman, or you're a black queer woman. That has sometimes been interpreted as something which is intensely atomizing. So intersections, you start thinking about the point of the crossroads rather than the roads and where they've come from and where they're going.
And why do you think it's become such a useful shorthand for people also on the left? Because you have, so there's a book right now, maybe not a lot of people have read it, but it's definitely taken Twitter over at the moment, called Kill All Normies by Angela Nagle. And she critiques both the left and the right for her, and for being, you know, too extreme online. Mm-hmm. And she critiques the left for taking identity to its and sort of like absurd zenith, where people identify as, pieces of cutlery, I think is her great example. I mean, that's a much critiqued argument, but I think what she picks up on is this trend within the left to use identity as a shorthand to talk about oppression. But where did that come from? At what point did people pick that up and not critique it as something that actually maybe isn't a helpful term?
Again, I think we have to look at the impact of neoliberalism. So why is it that intersectionality, which I do think is a very useful analytic tool, and more importantly, it's a very useful social tool. So when you're in an organizing space, and I don't know what it's like to be a trans woman of color, but I've got an understanding that a trans woman is vulnerable in very specific ways, and this is a way of opening up that conversation where they can tell me about their experience and tell me what's needed in terms of solidarity. I think that's great. But one of the most dangerous things in politics is stasis and complacency. So let's not act as though an understanding of oppression stops with Kimberlé Crenshaw. In terms of why it's been so popularized and indeed vulgarized, right? What Nagle is critiquing is a very vulgar form of intersectionality, which is just as bad as the vulgar Marxism, which says that the working class is white, owns a whippet and works in a factory. The reason behind this, and this is something which Nagle doesn't look at, which I think is a crying shame, is the impact of neoliberalism on social movements. You look at the 1960s and 70s as an incomplete revolution. Why is it that we are happy to talk about something which looks at us as, you know, hyper-isolated, atomized individuals, but not, say, the intellectual work of Angela Davis, who was also writing about race, class, and gender? And one of her critiques of intersectionality was that you cannot simply look at race, gender, class when you're looking at the obverse of positions of power, right? So that these things only come into being when you're talking about, you know, black working class women, for instance. If you're talking about a white moneyed man, Angela Davis would say, well, aren't you always talking about histories of racism then? You know, you have to look at these things in a much more bundled up and, you know, epistemically messy way in order to come to any understanding. And also you need one which is thoroughly grounded in a materialist analysis, one that looks at what's coming in and out of your bank account, as you put it, or indeed how the bank itself was founded in order to get anywhere at all. So one of those analyses is a lot more dangerous when it comes to the project of, I don't know, overthrowing capitalism than one which kind of treats you as a isolated, you know, piece of social debris floating around feeling injured.
If you could conceive then of a definition of class that you'd find most useful in the UK for people to come together and begin to fight the finite, like the, you know, the economic inequality that we're all facing right now, what would that look like?
Right. Are you in charge of how you make your money?
No.
Then you're probably working class. For me, it comes down to, I mean, again, outing myself as maybe a vulgar Marxist here, class is a property relation. So if you're part of a renter class, right, rather than a property owning class, whether you're part of a class which has unsustainable levels of debt, if you're in a precariously employed class, so maybe you have three part-time jobs, two of which are on 0 hours, you're working class. Again, Owen Hatherley, I think, puts it very well, which is we have come to imagine class as a set of cultural distinctions, which is why you can have some ridiculous figure like Owen Smith getting in a flap that his coffee wasn't served in a mug and it was in a nice little latte thing, because it's just this completely shallow, you know, analysis of like accoutrements and accessories. When you actually look at class in terms of money, and then you look at how class is racialized in terms of who is more likely to have less money. So you look at the racialized differential in terms of assets, right? Average household assets. It's a hugely racialized dynamic there. That's class. For me, it comes down to something really simple, which is what do you own and how do you make your peas?
Well, thank you for joining us. And then everyone can add that definition of class now to the canon.
I mean, it's just read Capital, isn't it? Like, it just sort of end up saying to people like, oh, just read Capital, man.
Just even on Wikipedia. Cool. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to this episode. We're having a little break for the next 2 weeks, but we'll be back on Thursday, 21st of September. Special thanks to Helen Hodnott, who produced this episode. I'm Kessie Major. See you in 2 weeks.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.